imports around 70 to 80% of its food, which, as we can see on this chart, shows just how much of each food commodity is imported to the nation, with the bulk of imports coming to Cuba from Venezuela and also from China. Let's now look into our first report that studies how Cuba's revolution has been given a brand identity and how it has been able to adapt and reform to suit the current economic climate.
In 1953, a young Fidel Castro gathered together a group of similar-minded people and over the next 5 years ousted then-president Fulgencio Batista. The Cuban Revolution is without doubt one of the most successful and, bizarrely, one of the most popular in the world, with teams of tourists flocking to the Caribbean island to immerse themselves in the atmosphere of La Revolución, adorning the Che Guevara berets, posing with classic cars, and losing themselves in the vibrant music and culture of the island. But the modern image of luscious beaches, Cuban cigars and cocktails has not always been the norm. The notion of communism left the United States very edgy, particularly during the 1960s with the Cuban Missile Crisis, sparking American nuclear families to build up an image of almost alien-like views of communism, which contributed to even more tension during the height of the Cold War. Yet the revolution has delivered Cuba with an economic dilemma. The US-imposed embargo on the nation has cost its financial status heavily, with some estimates placing the monetary value of the sanctions at around £553 billion, according to the Cubans. And the UN have estimated the value at a more conservative £130 billion over the last 6 decades.
Joining me in the studio is current affairs and impact analyst Mahan Abedin. Welcome. And Dr. Stephen Wilkinson from the University of Buckingham. He is also the director of the International Institute for the Study of Cuba. Well, gentlemen, thanks for being with us. Let me start with Professor Dr. Wilkinson. Cuba's revolution, it has molded itself over the years to be adaptable. And today you have the Cuban government who has hinted at lifting the grip on the private enterprises. And there's so many that they run. Hence allowing Cubans to seek extra income that they obviously need. And, of course, the reforms need to come in place. Do you think that this is an example of communism meeting, like, capitalism, which was embraced somewhat by the Chinese model, in a sense? And could it be the perfect balance between the two ideologies for Cuba?
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Kaveh. Yes, I mean, to answer your question immediately, one would say that perhaps the secret of Cuba's success in the face of the opposition it's had from the United States over the years is its adaptability and its pragmatic approach to dealing with its problems. I would say that the changes you're referring to have been going on for quite some time. In fact, since the collapse of the Soviet Union back in 1991, Cuba has been moving towards using market mechanisms in order to solve some of the problems inside the society and the economy.
All right, Mahan, the Cuban Revolution, it has survived, and we can talk about the death of its founder, Fidel Castro.
Yes.
Now, what do you think are the main reasons that this ideology has lived for so long, in spite of the virtual fall of communism elsewhere? And do you think that a socialist economy is actually a viable model for the island nation to thrive on financially? In this case, Cuba?
Well, Cuba really demonstrated its resilience when it outlived the former Soviet Union, because everyone was saying because their economy was so dependent on the Soviets and they had direct aid from the Soviet Union, it would immediately collapse. It hasn't. In fact, it's gone on to thrive. It's been there for 60 years. And also some of the innovative things they've done in recent years, they've opened up the economy to some extent. There's now some scope for private enterprise in Cuba, but it's still a very strictly socialist country. They've opened up the internet, and of course the tourism sector is picking up. So Cuba really is a resounding success story, particularly in view of its immediate environment, you know, very hostile giant neighbor to the north, which has tried to oust them repeatedly in the past 60 years, particularly in the early decades. I mean, they tried to assassinate Fidel Castro over a dozen times, but they were unsuccessful. So Cuba, yet by all accounts, by all credible accounts and standards, it really is a resounding success story.
Yeah, it sure is, from the sounds of it anyways. Okay, yeah. Thanks to both Mahan and Dr. Wilkinson. We're going to obviously see them later again in the program. It's time now to take a look at our second report that studies Cuba's rocky relationship with its northern neighbor, namely the U.S.
We've already touched on the situation during the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis, but ties between Cuba and the U.S. have frozen and thawed on several notable occasions. The most obvious differences in ties came between the U.S. and Cuba depending on the U.S. government at the time, with the Democrats tending to be more favorable towards Cuba than the Republicans, as demonstrated in 1999, when then-President Bill Clinton allowed travel restrictions to be eased between the two nations, even going as far as approving cultural and sporting exchanges. The election of George W. Bush saw relations deteriorate again, with the U.S. government labeling Cuba in its baseless axes of evil speech, spearheaded by the sinister and hawkish advisor, John Bolton. But it's in 2008, when Fidel Castro officially stood down and Barack Obama became president of the U.S., that tensions thawed the most, and the two countries saw their best relations in years, with Obama easing many sanctions and even traveling to Havana to meet Raul Castro. Obama also lifted the label of Cuba as being a state sponsor of terrorism and promised to close the infamous Guantanamo Bay base, a promise that Obama never managed to keep. Donald Trump, in his final weeks in office, however, reversed Obama's work and once again placed Cuba on the list of state sponsors of terrorism and once again created tension between the two sides. Yet in spite of the political to and fro between the two, it's the people of Cuba that have seen the real impact of sanctions, with around 15% of people in Cuba living in poverty, and the rest unable to make ends meet as well as they would like to. How then have the sanctions affected the daily lives of people in Cuba?
So there's a contradiction. In many ways, Cuba behaves very much as a developed country in terms of its commitment to health, education. People can talk in great detail and at great length about the contributions that Cuba has made to its own people in those terms, or the Cuban government has made. The other side of that, however, is precisely what you're talking about, and that is the prolonged effect of the longest sanctions, economic sanctions in world history, over 60 years. And that has done many things at a sort of, you know, macro level. It has completely distorted the Cuban economy, and Cubans at street level feel that fragility and feel that sense of precarious existence, certainly. I mean, there is food on the tables, nobody is starving, but it's a very kind of piecemeal approach to trying to get that food on the table.
What now remains to be seen is whether the upcoming reforms in Cuba that will allow more private enterprise with less control by the state, will it give the people of Cuba an opportunity to earn more money? Yet with tourism being a major source of foreign currency and opportunity for private businesses, it seems that until the global COVID-19 pandemic is brought under control, things may yet remain very challenging for the people and the government of Cuba.
Back with me in the studio is Mahan Abedin and Dr. Stephen Wilkinson. Welcome back to both of you. Dr. Wilkinson, the U.S. under Donald Trump, well, he reimposed sanctions on Cuba, labeled it a state sponsor of terrorism. Do you think the new president, Joe Biden, is going to be following the footsteps of Barack Obama in terms of easing ties with Cuba? And will Biden finally close the prison at Guantanamo Bay, as he has hinted at recently?
Well, Carvey, just to go back to your first question to begin the answer to this one, around the issue of ideology, I think one of the most important things to understand about this relationship with the United States is that the underlying, if you want to use a philosophical term, the episteme, that means the kind of the underlying basis of this confrontation, it is not seen the same way on both sides. So, for example, the United States almost consistently insists on seeing this as a relationship which is based around the conflict between socialism and capitalism. Whereas if you ask the average Cuban what they see the confrontation as being one between colonialism and independence.
Well, Mahan, it seems that the U.S. Is content on slapping economic sanctions pretty much on any nation that does not wish to follow its ideology. And, of course, not only Cuba, you have Venezuela, and of course, here in Iran, they're all on the list. Yet, in spite of these sanctions, all nations have shown resilience. Cuba is one, Iran for sure another. And they have shown some notion towards improving or economic improvements. Now, do you think Cuba, like Iran and Venezuela, have stood up successfully when it comes to sanctions and proving that they just don't really have the impact that, in this case, the U.S. intended to?
Well, I think sanctions, in all the three cases you pointed out, at least, Iran, Venezuela, and Cuba, what it tends to do is to actually improve national cohesion in these countries. So there may be an element of economic suffering, but people pull together. And that in itself defeats the sanctions, because one of the primary aim of these sanctions is not only just to economically cripple a country, but to actually incite unrest. And it clearly hasn't happened in any of these countries. And I'd just like to pick up on what your colleague just said, that the U.S. really is stuck in a prison in terms of how it deals with countries like Cuba, and in some ways, especially in relation to Cuba specifically, the U.S. is hostage to that very powerful lobby in Florida, the so-called Cuban lobby. But of course, it's not a Cuban lobby. It's all these American nut jobs lobby, which tend to view the Cuban system through the prism of the Cold War. And again, your guest is partially right, I think. There is a nationalistic element in the Cuban Revolution, but we can't downplay its socialist elements. And the socialist element, which I hope we will be able to discuss later in your show, has underpinned its success in the health sector, because Cuba has one of the most advanced health sectors in the world.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you. Many thanks to Mahan and also Dr. Wilkinson. Well, we're about to take a short break here on Economic Divide, so stay right where we are. Welcome back to Economic Divide with me, Kaveh Tahwahi. Time now to take a look at some of the other economic headlines hitting the front pages in our info news section. Well, first up, China has taken its first step to ousting the U.S. as the world's largest economy by overtaking the Americans as the European Union's largest trading partner. Figures show that trade between China and the EU is valued at $709 billion compared to $671 billion for the U.S. in the year 2020. Well, Bitcoin has breached the iconic $50,000 mark, seeing the currency rise by 72% since the start of the year. Well, the price surge comes following an announcement by Tesla CEO Elon Musk that he had purchased $1.5 billion of the cryptocurrency. However, critics say that the fluctuation seen still makes the currency an unstable commodity. Next up, following from our episode on billionaires last week, two of the world's richest men, namely Jeff Bezos and Mukesh Ambani, are battling over a $3.4 billion contract of retail sales in India. Bezos' Amazon hopes to gain a slice of the 1,800 retail stores across 420 Indian cities. However, Ambani's reliance is showing Amazon that local knowledge and ready cash are strong enough to oust Amazon's interest in India. And finally, the mining company Rio Tinto has announced that it is expected to pay out a record $9 billion in dividends following a 20% rise in profit due to China's demand for iron ore. So the payout will be the world's second largest mining company's largest ever payout in its 148-year history. Well, it's time now to take a look at our final report of the show, which examines the possible routes out of the red for Cuba, looking at how certain industries and trade may pick up again in the near future.
With tensions in the past rising and falling in parallel with respective U.S. governments at the time, the future economic situation in Cuba may depend in part on the ambitious and political economic foreign policy of current President Joe Biden. However, it's not just politics that dictate just how the Cuban economy will fare in the near future. As we've briefly touched upon earlier in the show, one of the main sources of foreign currency income to Cuba is the flow of tourism, with visitors to the island rising from under 750,000 in 1995 to over 4.6 million in 2018, and contributing to around 3% of the total GDP. With the potential reforms on private enterprise also taking place in Cuba, the future looks quite bright. However, as with the rest of the world, there's a huge hurdle to cross first. The COVID-19 virus has not impacted Cuba as heavily as other places, with the island managing the spread of the virus relatively well. However, international travel, aviation and tourism has suffered extremely heavy losses at the hand of the virus, and the impact has literally meant that Cuban tourism is closed for now. Many Cubans currently rely on remittances sent to the island from the US, and with over 2.3 million Cubans living in America, the opportunity to send money home is plenty, yet in the long term, it's not an ideal solution. However, Cuba has shown that it's able to manage well in times of crisis, as demonstrated by its handling of the virus, and with a highly educated population, boasting 100% literacy rates from both males and females, and having some of the best medical doctors in the world, Cuba has shown the world how self-sufficient it can be. So the future now lies in the hands of both the people and the government of Cuba, as well as partly in the hands of external partners and nations, meaning how the people of Cuba view their future, either tied to better relations with the US, or by seeking more ties with new or existing partners, depends what happens on a political scale, and now it seems medically, in order to emerge from the current situation.
Cuba's always looked elsewhere. It's always tried to keep those international alliances going, and a huge part of that for over 30 years, but principally now with the pandemic, has been through internationalism, through medical internationalism and the exchange of medical expertise or pharmaceuticals in exchange for basic commodities. In terms of the change of US administration, I don't think it could have got worse for Cuba than it had been under Trump. The number of restrictions that were strengthened under Trump's administration, including remittances, including limiting the most obvious tourist market, which is the US market, severely limiting that. And then one of his last acts before leaving office was to put Cuba on the what used to be the axis of evil. So it can't get worse than that. It can't be harder than that.
I'm pleased to welcome back one more time current affairs and impact analyst Mahan Abedin and director of the International Institute for the Study of Cuba from the University of Buckingham, Dr. Stephen Wilkinson. Gentlemen, welcome back. Dr. Wilkinson, my final question. Cuba, like many other nations around the world, suffered heavily at the hands of the COVID-19, not necessarily in the number of deaths, which currently stands at less than 300, but also more so due to the impact of the virus on the tourism of the country. Do you feel that in spite of the 11% GDP slump that was recorded in 2020 by Cuba, that the economy can reemerge from the pandemic and get back to its former self?
Well, I mean, that's a big question. I'm talking to you from a country which has suffered a very similar fall in GDP, Great Britain, and we don't know what our economy will look like going forward. So it's very difficult to predict in terms of how this pandemic is going to play out. I would say that it is the case that Cuba's economy has been heavily switched towards tourism as one of the main foreign currency earners. And it's hard to see, in terms of the global pandemic, a return to the kinds of tourism that we had in the past coming back to Cuba very quickly. So one would say on that count, the picture is not very optimistic for Cuba at this stage. However, on the other hand, one of the other main planks of the Cuban economy now, and arguably one of its most successful projects, has been the development of its biotechnology industry. Yeah. And in that, there is a great deal of optimism for Cuba. Cuba has developed four candidate vaccines against the coronavirus, and they're going to come on stream within the next few weeks. And Cuba has the capacity to manufacture 100 million doses of this very quickly. Now, that means that Cuba could become a key global player in dealing with this pandemic, particularly in developing countries. And if the vaccines that Cuba have produced are effective, then Cuba could become extremely important and benefit enormously from the pandemic in this regard.
Okay, many thanks to Dr. Stephen Wilkinson, director of the International Institute for the Study of Cuba. and lecturer at the University of Buckingham. It was great having you on Economic Divide.
Thank you.
All right, Mohan, Cuba has done very well in controlling the coronavirus, respectively, regarding its compared to other nations. Do you think that having a well-educated population, which it does, has contributed to this feat? And is education the key to reignite the Cuban economy? I mean, after all, Cuba can't rely on just tourism or its for its sole economic pillar.
Well, I think, in short, it's Cuba's health sector that's ensured it's weathered the storm in relation to COVID-19. As I stated earlier, it's one of the best health systems in the world. It used to export doctors and nurses throughout the so-called third world, particularly in Africa. So it's not a surprise at all that Cuba has this capacity to produce 100 million doses of the coronavirus, not only to look after its own population, but then to export that to other parts of the world. Look, Cuba is a very resilient country. I mean, education is a part of it, but let's face it, this is a country that's withstood decades of U.S. hostility. It survived the downfall of the former Soviet Union, which was its close ally during the Cold War. You know, it's weathered all sorts of storms, and it stood tall for 60 years. So, you know, I think the system there is very resilient. Cuba will come out of this stronger, I believe. And also, again, from a health perspective, at least a public health perspective, it will continue to set an example for the rest of the world. Let's not forget, this is a tiny country, and yet it's had so many dramatic achievements in the health sector, but also, I hasten to add, in the educational sector as well.
Great. Thank you so much for that. We do appreciate it, Mohan.
Yeah, you're welcome.
That's Mohan Abedin there. Thank you. And Dr. Stephen Wilkinson also, it was great to hear from both of them. The Cuban Revolution has so far stood the test of time, with not only the founder of the revolution dead, but also with communism morphing into a very different concept since the collapse of the Iron Curtain and the fall of the Soviet Union. Yet it is the very revolution that has given Cuba an identity, a brand, with tourists flocking to the island to sample the music, the culture, and of course, embrace a taste of the revolution through the purchase of Che Guevara merchandise as a prime example. Yet for Cuba, the notion of fighting economic sanctions imposed by the U.S., as well as seeing one of its main sources of income dry up due to the COVID-19 pandemic, limited travel to Cuba, and has proven to take its toll on the country, hence forcing to adapt its business ideology to allow its citizens to gain private wealth. What now remains to be seen is just how successful this plan becomes and whether future relations between Cuba and the U.S. and the rest of the world and bring back much-needed foreign investment into the country. That's about all the time we have on this episode. On behalf of myself, Trevor Tavley, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Interesting traditions of Iranians is chanting while doing a job. For example, chanting at the time of planting or harvesting rice in the paddy fields of northern Iran. Or chanting at the time of weaving rich, beautiful Iranian carpets. Or the songs which Iranian coppersmith in Zanjan sing at the time of work.
El balat dalanda yek salam var. El bala başmaqların yağlaram, üstünə gül bağlaram. El bala gedirsən tez geyirsən.
These songs are aimed at creating harmony or encouragement. Today we are going to south of Iran in order to get familiar with Rezif ritual, which is actually a kind of work-related chanting. Rezif is a traditional ritual in southern Iran, used to be played out by native sailors before they set foot on the mainland to get rid of long journey exhaustion. Rezif ritual has its roots in work-related songs. The profession of the residents of southern Iran is mostly related to sea and sailing, and Rezif ritual reminds many of the special responsibilities of sailors and fishermen. Rezif ritual has been invented to remind sailors of the works like installing sails, fishing, pulling up the anchor, and so on. Residents of southern Iran, by holding Rezif ritual in different ceremonies, try to remind people of the ancient ritual of sailing and sailors' attempts for making bread. Reading Rezif is similar to reading travelogues in the sense that tells the story of sailors' story in a melodious tone. Also mentioning the name of the Prophet of Islam and his progeny, peace upon them, as well as sending salutations to Prophet Muhammad and his progeny, are other parts of this traditional ritual. am now in the paradise-like Eshmaeiland in southern Iran. Today, a Resif ritual is going to be held in this island. I'm so excited to see this great ritual. In a Resif ritual, two groups of 8 to 20 members, which most of them wear white, stand against each other and begin the ceremony. The group members hold sticks made of bamboo and perform symbolic movements. Musicians play an important role in this ritual. Usually, there are three people who play duhol, two other people who play the daf, and two others who play shelenj. Shelenj is the local name of a small cymbal. Resif ritual is held in a simple way, and there is no trace of luxuries or other impractical equipment in it. The leader of Resif ritual is standing at the center of the square, holding a drum, while also synchronizing the chants, songs, and tones with other members. The musicians of this group, who are responsible for doing the major job, are standing in the middle of the square, while the two set groups are standing on the two sides of these musicians. The pleasant tone of Resif ritual reminds us of the spirituality which lacks in today's world. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Thursday, the United States carried out airstrikes against facilities belonging to anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border. White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki said the raid authorized by Biden had been, quote, deliberate and meant to de-escalate the overall situation in both eastern Syria and Iraq. The military action was said to be in retaliation for recent attacks against American bases and missions in Iraq, which Washington has blamed on so-called Iran-backed Iraqi resistance groups. In the latest such attacks, rockets hit Baghdad's Green Zone, which houses the U.S. Embassy and other missions on Monday. The American military base at the Erbil International Airport had similarly been attacked days earlier. The Iraqi resistance groups and many Iraqi officials have, however, roundly dismissed Washington's allegations, blaming rogue elements. Pro-Western media outlets describe the U.S. air raid on the Iraq-Syria border as a signal to Iran, which they claim is using Iraq's PMU as a, quote, proxy force in the neighboring country, allegations that Tehran has categorically denied.
Joe Biden is a neocon. He has surrounded himself in his foreign policy, his national security advisor, secretary of state, ambassador to the United Nations, the Pentagon, has surrounded himself with the same cast of characters to a very large degree who took care of foreign policy during both the Clinton administration and the Obama administration. This is a very aggressive group.
Damascus has slammed the U.S. air raid as a cowardly act of aggression, describing it as a bad sign from the administration of the new president, Joe Biden. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, also condemned the U.S. attack as a continuation of raids carried out by Israel on Syria in violation of international law. U.S. President Joe Biden's order to attack the Iraqi anti-terrorism groups on the border with Syria has been criticized both at home and abroad. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said on Friday that the United States had notified Moscow of the impending attack on the PMU facility 4 or 5 minutes ahead of time. The Russian Foreign Minister said the U.S. military is present on the Syrian soil illegally in violation of all norms of international law, including Security Council resolutions on the reconciliation in the Syrian Arab Republic. He said Russia had received unconfirmed information that the U.S. is planning to stay in Syria indefinitely. Meanwhile, the Chinese Foreign Ministry also reacted to the U.S. air raid, warning against any action that further complicates the situation in the crisis-hit Syria. Also, a number of Democratic U.S. lawmakers have found faults with the legal justifications of President Joe Biden's administration for the airstrikes, demanding that the officials at the White House immediately brief Congress on the matter. Many expected the Biden era to mark a departure from the damaging and warmongering approach of the Trump administration. It now appears that Biden is following the footsteps of the former president.
Really, Joe Biden has a career as a neocon. He supported the Iraq war and the invasion and occupation of Iraq when he was in the Senate, and in a very influential position as the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. As the vice president, he was personally tasked with dealing with the coup in Ukraine and the overthrow of the government, the constitution of a new government that would meet the needs or demands of Washington. And we could go on and on. I mean, going back to wars in Central America in the 1980s, Trump, when some of the liberals who follow and support Biden said when Trump ordered the missiles fired into Syria early in his presidency, that he could, that's what made him presidential. So I guess, you know, we have to take it that making war is what makes a U.S. president a real president.
Biden authorized the attack in another sovereign state in his second month in office. Does he really have a change in the U.S. foreign policy in mind? Or are there more conflicts to come?
The world will never forget the gruesome assassination of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The outspoken critic of the Saudi regime was killed and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Shortly after the killing, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency assessed with high confidence that Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, had personally ordered the assassination. The case turned into a severe political storm, triggering global condemnation of the Saudis. However, then U.S. President Donald Trump chose to stand with the notorious Crown Prince and rejected calls to condemn him. Trump's White House dismissed intelligence that bin Salman personally ordered the killing. The former American president made no secret of what was behind his unrelenting support for bin Salman. Trump stressed that he did not want to sacrifice billions of dollars in U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia over the matter. The previous U.S. administration blocked the release of the intelligence community's findings into the killing. Trump's successor, Joe Biden, is apparently taking a different course. Biden said during a presidential campaign rally that Khashoggi was murdered and that he believes the Crown Prince ordered the hit. His administration is now releasing a declassified version of a top-secret intelligence report that singles out the Saudi crown prince for at least giving the go-ahead for the assassination, if not directly ordering it. Biden has pledged to take a tough line on Saudi Arabia's human rights violations and its war on Yemen.
Biden, I think, is signaling MBS and the world that the United States is getting back on board as a leader in diplomacy, as a world leader. And you're not going to be those things if you're led around the world by the nose by a Saudi feudal prince. That's got to change. Didn't change under Trump. Didn't change under Obama. I hope to see Biden change that.
The new U.S. administration has made some policy changes regarding Saudi Arabia. U.S. President Joe Biden has ended American support for offensive operations in the Saudi-led war in Yemen and has freezed the sales of weapons to the kingdom. These are not looking very bright for the relationship between the two allies, at least for now. The release of the report on the assassination of Khashoggi is expected to further strain the ties between the two sides. However, during a call with the Saudi king on Thursday, Biden told Salman that he would work for bilateral ties as strongly and transparently as possible. Biden and top administration officials have stressed that they are committed to Saudi Arabia's security. Biden has been in office for a little more than a month, and it is definitely too soon to judge his decisions. The Saudi kingdom is right now a major foreign policy dilemma for the White House. Even if Biden is willing to punish the Saudis for their rights violations and destabilizing actions like their war in Yemen, the road ahead for him will be very bumpy. This is because the kingdom is a long-standing U.S. ally with many powerful friends in Washington. Meanwhile, Saudi petrodollars will definitely not be easy for the Americans to resist.
The Israeli regime is infamous for breaking a long list of international laws, which has drawn worldwide condemnation. Back in 2020, the United Nations General Assembly condemned Israel the most, as it adopted 17 resolutions against Tel Aviv's violation of international laws. That's almost three times more compared with the rest of the world combined, standing at six. The Gaza Strip has been subjected to the longest blockade in modern history. In 2007, Israel imposed a land, sea, and air blockade on Gaza. The inhumane blockade severely restricts imports and exports, people's movements in and out of Gaza, and access to agricultural land and fishing waters, denying Palestinians of their basic human rights. All of these actions are against international law. Israel also demolishes the homes of Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem outlets and elsewhere in the West Bank in order to provide land for building illegal settlements. According to the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2334, settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem outlets are a flagrant violation under international law. Adding to that, Israel frequently targets military positions inside the war-hit Syria, hitting more than 500 spots in the year 2020. Moreover, Israeli aircrafts repeatedly violate Lebanon's airspace on a daily basis, which, again, is a clear violation of international law, in this case, Lebanon's sovereignty. The regime is also the only possessor of nuclear warheads in the region. However, it has always refused to accept or deny having nuclear weapons. Israel has always turned a deaf ear to international calls for nuclear transparency, as it has never allowed inspections of its nuclear facilities and has refrained from joining the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Recently, reports revealed that Tel Aviv was expanding its Dimona nuclear facility, which provides the regime with material needed for its nuclear arsenal. The regime is estimated to have between 100 to 400 atomic warheads. That is why Israel has constantly accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of weaponization of its peaceful nuclear program. Meanwhile, it has carried out several assassination operations against Iranian nuclear scientists over the past decade, all in defiance of international law.
Well, we don't really need the U.S. Claims to for us to believe that Israel is breaking international law. It's been doing that ever since it claimed independence 70 years ago. So, and it's the worst offender. There's no question that Israel, it's an occupying, it occupies, terrorizes 70 years. No other country. You can think of Myanmar. It was very bad with its Muslims, but not even one tenth of what Israel does really every day.
3 years after former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration withdrew from the United Nations Human Rights Council, his successor Joe Biden has moved to rejoin the panel for the 2022-24 term. Washington walked away from the council during Trump's term in office in 2018, accusing it of displaying hostility toward Israel. That is why Washington's bid to rejoin the Geneva-based rights body is aimed at eliminating the so-called unfair focus on Israel. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv has been widely condemned internationally for its violation of international laws. The occupying regime is routinely on the UN General Assembly's agenda since late 2006 and is condemned for violations, as mentioned, in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. Previously, Biden stated his opposition to the expansion of illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. He also said the only way to reach peace between Palestine and Israel is a two-state solution. However, his administration's move to shield Israel against international outcry over its crimes somehow contradicts his earlier remarks about the Palestine-Israel issue.
Of course, it's undermining the UN. The UN's very weak anyway. It's got really no political clout because it's still ruled by the veto in the Security Council, and any reasonable requests and laws are vetoed. So it doesn't really have any clout now. But it does have these committees, and it does get some kind of press coverage, and it has credibility. People don't see the UN as an evil force.
The Israeli regime's malicious acts are not hidden from the eyes of international human rights bodies. However, Washington's attempt does not only seem unfair, but also undermines the UN Rights Council's credibility. When Israel holds the record for the most broken UN resolutions, the credibility of the UN as a rights body comes into question.
The planned U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan hangs in the balance as reports show Washington plans to possibly extend its presence in the war-torn country. Afghanistan's neighbor Pakistan has now joined the fray, with the Pakistani ambassador to Washington saying the U.S. should consult the Taliban on any extension of a May 1st deadline for full troop pullout under the Trump-era deal. Asad Majid Khan warned the U.S. against any unilateral decision. Khan noted the Biden administration's decision to extend military presence in Afghanistan will tarnish the cold credibility of the United States.
It is heartening to know that even high levels of the Pakistani government are speaking truth. That is a truthful statement. It is only going to sully the name and the nation of America, my birth nation, all the more that we are continuously sending American sons and daughters off to wars that have no purpose, no reason. And I agree with the Pakistani government official. I agree with him wholeheartedly.
Pakistan is widely seen as a major player in Afghanistan that wields significant influence over the Taliban. More than a year after Trump's administration signed a deal with the Taliban, U.S. and European officials say the militants have failed to abide by their commitments. They say conditions are not conducive to advancing the peace process amid the surge in violence, which they blame on the Taliban. The militants deny this and warn they will resume attacks on U.S.-led foreign forces unless the May deadline is respected.
But the Taliban are a useful tool where, at the high ranks, they're basically doing whatever their marching orders are. And the United States has proven time and time again, if there is no reason to have a war, we'll make one up. We just continuously create some sort of scenario. What realistic threat does Afghanistan and the Taliban pose to the greatest military in the history of the world? None. Zero. They pose no threat to us at all.
The new U.S. administration is rolling back Trump's policy, the withdrawal deal with the Taliban included. On the surface, the U.S. has steadily insisted it does not want Afghanistan to turn into what it calls a launching pad for new acts of terror like the 9/11 attacks of 2011. Some say with Biden at the White House, the United States is using Taliban attacks as a pretext to extend their presence in Afghanistan.
The intention is to keep American troops, Marines like me, keep them in Afghanistan to help continue running the heroin and ultimately do all sorts of nefarious, horrible things and killing war crimes and crimes against humanity, killing ungodly amounts of innocent people in Afghanistan under the pretext that we're fighting some war against a nation which poses no threat, and extend military might in line with the global spectrum dominance agenda.
Another theory maintains the Biden administration is under pressure from arms manufacturers to extend its stay in Afghanistan. Earlier this month, a congressional group recommended that President Biden extend the May 1st deadline for withdrawing troops. Word is, two of the group's three co-chairs and nine of its 12 plenary members have had financial ties to major defense contractors. The arms industry soaks up more than half of the $740 billion defense budget and will gain the protracted U.S. military involvement overseas. American author James Michener predicted during a visit to Afghanistan in 1955 that Russia and the United States would invade Afghanistan and both would come to regret it. That prediction came true. The Soviets invaded and were forced to leave Afghanistan in disgrace in the 1980s. Now, impartial military experts in the U.S. and its Western allies say the invasion of Afghanistan was a waste of blood and treasure from the very beginning and that this is an unwinnable war. They also advise the U.S. and other occupiers to seek a face-saving retreat from Afghanistan that has come to be known as a graveyard of empires.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
all of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
Benefiting from the innovation and enthusiasm of youth, as well as the experience of veterans in the management of the country. Sometimes, a youth goes to a different places and puts forward an important idea. But they do not listen to him, and then he comes and meets with me. Later, when I share his idea with experts, they confirm that he's right, that it is an important idea, and that the youth will be able to carry it out. Therefore, I believe that the country should make the most of youth's creativity, enthusiasm, and high morale. They are our children. They are the children of the country, and the country has the right to benefit from them. So we can benefit from youth on the issue of managerial positions and on this one. However, when I say that some managerial tasks should be entrusted to youth, this does not mean that we should completely eliminate previous generations. This is not what I mean. In different circumstances, we can benefit from the management of youth and of veterans. This has been the case since the beginning of the revolution.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Some people say that Imam entrusted Friday prayer leadership in Tehran to a 40-year-old man, this humble person. Yes, but he also entrusted that duty in Kermanshah to an 80-year-old clergy. And in Yazd, Shiraz, Mashhad, Tabriz, and other cities, he appointed great men and scholars who were in their 70s. Necessity dictates different actions. In the beginning of the revolution, Imam appointed a youth aged less than 30 years as a commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, and he appointed a man about 60 years as a commander of the Grand Force of the Islamic Republic of Iran Army. In different situations, there are different decisions. Sometimes necessity dictates that you appoint a young manager, and sometimes it dictates that you appoint an experienced manager. When we are close to election time, I will raise more points about the establishment of a young Hezbollahi administration.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Around the world with reporters.
The U.S. has finally released a long-awaited report on the gruesome murder of Jamal Khashoggi, confirming that the Crown Prince had personally approved an operation to capture or kill him. Accordingly, the U.S. says it has imposed sanctions against Saudi Arabia over the murder. However, Washington's restrictions only target members of the Saudi Royal Guard's Rapid Intervention Force, not their patron and commander, Mohammed bin Salman. That once again exposes Washington's double standard in dealing with criminals, despite its own intelligence.